Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. New York Times best-selling crime authors Caitlin Rother and Greg Olson have joined up to release this compilation of incredible murder cases from Florida, South Carolina, and Georgia. In Florida, a former flight attendant murders her multimillionaire boyfriend of 18 years using a gun, a knife, a hammer, and possibly poison gin, claiming he was abusive for years and put a loaded gun to her head. A woman with a history of violent, drug-addicted boyfriends kills her latest lover after only a few weeks together, alleging that he forced a gun into her mouth in a drug-induced rage. A 15-year-old girl falls in love and wants to have a baby with a boyfriend who is 4 years older. Her mother, who wants to end the relationship, ends up dead after being stabbed, choked, and injected with a syringe loaded with bleach. A 16-year-old girl and her 20-year-old boyfriend conspire to fatally bludgeon her disapproving father with a baseball bat. In Georgia, a socialite wife of a multimillionaire is fatally shot by a flower delivery man on the day of a key divorce hearing. A crooked businessman trying to go straight is shot in his driveway by a hitman wearing a ski mask and camouflage gear. A contract for hire murder advertised in Soldier of Fortune magazine. A Gulf War veteran and father of three is kidnapped, beaten, and stabbed by the lover of his on-and-off-again wife, who wants to collect life insurance benefits that pay off her house. In South Carolina, a woman goes to the electric chair after a vengeful feud over a dead calf turns fatal. The state's most prolific serial killer manages to kill a fellow prisoner while on death row, and a young white man tries to incite a race war by fatally shooting 9 African Americans during Bible study in a historic church. The book that we're featuring this evening is Love Gone Wrong from the Notorious USA series with my special guest, journalist and author, Caitlin Rother. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Caitlin Rother.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Thank you very much. Good to have you back, and some more amazing...
How many times is it now?
It's been a few.
It's been quite a few.
It's been quite a few, and you've been back. You've been here right from the very beginning, back in 2010.
Yes, I have.
So there you go. Let's get to this story because we've got a lot to cover. And also, we want to do an update on the Dead Reckoning, the new edition. So we've got a lot to cover. Why do this book? Tell us about the Notorious USA series first, and then tell us what was the criteria, or how did you choose these stories? What was sort of the theme you had to do Love Gone Wrong? Tell us a little about the Notorious USA series, and then the impetus for Love Gone Wrong.
Okay, the series was launched by Greg Olson, who's a good friend and a fellow true crime author, best-selling author. And he basically had some other authors do, it's basically a state-by-state look different, you know, notorious murder cases. And they could be old, they could be new. Basically, I get that freedom to do whatever I want. So some authors do a big number of cases and just write a little bit about each one. But, I mean, I don't know how to write short. It's not in my blood. So that's why I quit newspapers. I wanted to work on a shorter number of stories and kind of go a little bit more in depth. So they're each kind of, you know, what we call shorts, anywhere from mine range from, I don't know, 18,000 to 23,000 words each, state by state. And, you know, I started out with South Carolina. The one about the dead calf, the complicated woman is the title of that one. And I started looking for historic cases because I've never done that before. And I thought, well, that would be cool. That would be fun. I've always been kind of forced into the criteria of the publishers these days. They want these brand new cases that are on TV. I wanted to do something different. So my criteria, no one set this for me. I basically just looked what was interesting for me and something different. And because I've been having to write stories that everybody's kind of heard about already, at least and you know on the news or whatever, I wanted to pick some that were a little bit more obscure. So I ended up picking some notorious cases in South Carolina. There were three. And actually, one of them was in the news, and it's still in Storm Roof, the one about the guy who killed the people in the church. But I picked two right. older cases. One, Sue Logue, who was the first woman in South Carolina to be electrocuted in the and so to get the death penalty. And then a guy, Pee Wee Gaskins, who was also got the death penalty, but he was one of these guys who claimed to have killed, you know, 80 to 100 people, but, you know, most right. people who knew him thought he was exaggerating, and there were 14 murders. So I was kind of looking for, you know, the worst, but also unique. So, and then in some of the other ones, which I'm sure we'll get to later, but kind of, you know, I wanted to do a mix. So state by state, in Florida, I found two pairs of cases where we had similar circumstances, but different outcomes, very different outcomes. And so there were two pairs of those. And then in Georgia, there was an FBI source that I had who I was working with a little bit on some documents and some interesting backstory, and ended up putting together some stuff in Georgia. So it really, there wasn't any one specific thing, but when I had to title it, I had to look for something. And the theme that I saw, not every single case I picked, but most of them had to do with what I thought was love gone wrong, and that is mothers, kids killing their parents, which is a pretty twisted version of that, boyfriends, girlfriends killing their boyfriends, and, you know, and in many cases, you know, I find that it's more interesting for many of our readers of the true crime genre who are women to read about women killing people. So I always look for an interesting female character. So anyway, those were some of my criteria.
Now, let's get right to one of the stories, because I said,
okay.
like, we've got so much to cover, and we're just going to be able to touch on a few of these stories and
yeah,
not
fine.
Go so in-depth, but they're just incredible stories. So as you talk about some amazing female characters, let's talk about Melissa Webb, who's 28 years old in this story, and Brian Sorrentino,
uh-huh.
and he's 30 years old, and they're Fort Myers, Florida. So these people are addicted to oxycodone, and they don't got a lot of money. They're split up, but they're still living together, and this is August 2011. So
mm-hmm.
tell us a little bit about their circumstances, and who is Melissa Webb to start?
Well, this case was the last one that I did in this state in Florida, so I actually had planned to do a short version of this case. I thought it was going to be one of the shorter ones of the four that I picked for Florida. And as I got more and more into this case, I really felt like there was something wrong here. It's one of those cases that's hard to prove. It's one of those things where she's already a felon for stealing. She's a drug user. You know, they don't seem like very sympathetic characters. The boyfriend, quote-unquote boyfriend, they'd hardly known each other for very long. You know, on the face of it, it wasn't that interesting a case, but the more I got into it, the more I learned about Melissa, the more I realized our justice system is kind of screwed up at times. And that's one of the things that I'll, you know, that draws me to some of the cases I write about, where I feel like there's been something that people have not gotten a specific, you know, a particularly fair chance in the system. So the reason I say that is, it turns out she is Native American, and there are some statistics from the Department of Justice that show that Native American women are 2.5 times more likely to be raped than women of other ethnicities. And I just thought, wow, that's pretty interesting. And in her background, as it turns out, I interviewed her mother, and her mother said, you know, I don't agree with the choices she's made in her life. You know, she is addicted to drugs. She's, you know, I don't allow her to live with me when she's doing drugs, but she's not a killer. And so the more I learned about her, she had been raped a number of times by these boyfriends that she'd had, you know, or not, some of them were boyfriends, some of them were strangers. And, you know, she just sounded like she just had a rough time of it from the get-go. And, you know, it just, the whole story as it played out, it's like she's already in the system, she's already a felon, and so she basically, the way the laws are written, she didn't really have a chance, I thought. So she was defending herself. This is her story. Her story is that this guy who also was a drug addict, and his family was kind of tied in with the law enforcement in town, even though he was a drug addict. His stepfather worked for the sheriff's department. So, and it's a small town. And so anyway, it was just sort of the way that it went. There was evidence that didn't really get to be presented to the jury about what happened in the room, and there were guns, and when she got back from being out and he was drugged, but she claims that he was paranoid and mixed all these different kinds of drugs, cocaine and steroids in addition to the oxycodone, and was in a rage, and they had been fighting, and that he threatened her and said he was going to kill her and came after her, fired a shot into the ceiling, and then put the gun in her mouth. And so she claims, you know, she was just trying to defend herself, and she saw there was another gun downstairs, which is a shotgun. So even when she got the gun away from him, he was going downstairs, she thought, to get the shotgun, and which is no match for the small gun. And anyway, and what ended up happening is, there was evidence in the apartment to prove some of this, but the sheriff's department didn't collect it. The defense hired an expert. The expert was not allowed to present any of this information. Anyway, I ended up making it about three times longer than what I was going to, because I just really felt like, I just felt like some of this evidence should be seen by somebody, because it was, you know, there was no media coverage of this case at all. So I just felt strongly that this case just at least needed to have somebody look at it in a more objective way.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this case, because the audience won't have any clue of the story that we're talking about. But and what I want you to go, what wasn't clear to me, and I think it obviously wasn't raised in the defense properly, is or wasn't investigated properly, is the contention that she had that she fired a shot in this self-defense. You think
right.
It must be a crucial thing to be able to investigate it. And you say the police service in this book say they didn't find any bullet hole whatsoever to back up her assertion that that's what she did in this self-defense.
Well, I think he fired a shot that went into the ceiling before he stuck
right.
it in her mouth. And then she fired two shots into him, and one of the shots that went through his skull, they never found it in the wall when it should have been found, because it went through and through. So there were two points. So they never really investigated the hole in the ceiling. The defense went back, removed that portion of the ceiling. It was there was a water stain, so it clearly was leaking. So there clearly was a hole there, but the prosecution really never really investigated that. And the judge wouldn't let it in. So the defense hires this expert to basically look at all this, take the ceiling apart, wrote a big report, 37 pages, and was not allowed to show it to the jury, was not allowed to testify. And so, to me, that just didn't seem right. That didn't seem right.
But to bolster the prosecution's case, and it does bolster the prosecution's case because it becomes part of the evidence that shows, again, it refutes self-defense in terms of the cover-up after the fact. And so it is somewhat pathetic, really, because she calls her ex-boyfriend, this guy named Rick Sigler. Tell us a little bit about what she does. And this really doesn't do any benefit to her in this case at all, does it?
She calls a number of people, and people call her, and her problem is she tells people different stories. And the rationale she uses that is essentially, well, they're not going to believe me because I'm already a felon, which is true, but it also shows, you know, she did lie, so you can't argue with that. She told different people different things about what happened to the body afterwards. So that is still not even clear to me, honestly. She told Rick something about how she buried the body. Now, that doesn't mean she buried the body. That meant to me, because, you know, people are not as precise with their language as you and I might be as writers. I often find that where you, people may say something, but they aren't being specific. They're saying, you know, like, she didn't say we buried the body because it, you know. Anyway, my point in that is I think there's some wiggle room in there. She told different people different things. The guy who she said buried the body had been arrested some ridiculous number of times, and I read his deposition, and it was really incoherent. And so he never was even in court, so they couldn't even question him. And if he's the guy who buried the body for her, which is what she claimed, there was never that never got into court either. So I just I guess all I'm saying is I can't prove what happened. I don't know whether she buried the body or whether he buried the body, but the body was found across state lines or county lines, whatever it was, county lines. And that didn't look good. So the jury basically said, well, who takes a body, you know, no matter how it got there, who takes a body to across state lines and buries it like that, doesn't tell anyone, the gun's missing, it just looks really bad. And she told people different stories. And she's a drug addict, and, you know, we don't like drug addicts. That's pretty much our society. So, you know, and I'm not defending her. I'm just saying I just felt like her case didn't get a fair look. That's all. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there, so.
Well, if you put in what you do bring up, too, is that she does have this background of being raped at 13.
Yeah.
Refused to press charges, but this led to a falling out with her father. Instead of her father being compassionate and sympathetic, he has a falling out because she can't go to the authorities at 13. That's
bizarre. It sounds like a pretty dysfunctional situation.
Yeah, at least. And then she's raped again at 16. She tried to report the rape, but there was a lack of evidence, so there was no arrest.
Right.
So.
And then after a certain point, I think she kind of gave up, you know, and it kept happening.
Well, it also does tie into the idea that I mean, I'm just looking at sort of other courts. We'll say, again, what do I know? Canadian courts. Where they would have taken into consideration all of that abuse background and would have lent credibility that she felt that she was a battered woman or she was in this self-defense mode.
Right.
At the same time, she did provide, I thought, somewhat credible evidence, at least, in court of abuse, that this man was abusive. So whether that was proven or not, I wasn't at the court.
Right. Well, and she also tried to present that whole case separately. You know, the whole stand your ground law that's been so controversial in Florida with the Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case. That was, I guess, a pretty new law at the time and still pretty controversial. And they tried to get her a defense based on that, and they threw it out of court. So what's odd to me is that Zimmerman gets off, and she isn't allowed to use that defense. That to me just was like bizarre. You know, not fairly applied, you know. Anyway.
And the other thing, too, what you do bring up in each group of the state crime stories that you have picked is that a fascinating statistic as well, that you talk about South Carolina and the imprisonment per capita ratio. So maybe tell us about that before we move to another story.
I'm going to have to look that up. Hold on. I don't remember the statistics off the top of my head. I don't know where that is. I also honestly don't have that in my memory. So, here it is. Hold on. Violent crime, 51% higher than the national average in 2010. Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Okay, there you have it.
Just a super high per capita imprisonment rate in South Carolina as well.
33% more murders today than California and Texas. More inmates per capita in the 32 prisons than any other state. That was in 1994. And even after a significant overall drop in crime nationally in the years that followed, the violent crime rate was still 51% higher than the national average in 2010. And the other thing that I learned I thought South Carolina was going to be the hardest state to do research on. It ended up being the easiest because What I found was this really interesting sociological angle. Basically, so much racial strife in that state. I mean, a lot of this stuff that I was writing about is about the white people not you know, not liking the black people. And Dylan, you know, and that's such an issue. We have such a racial divide in our country right now that, you know, the presidential campaign has really brought that out into the open that I didn't even realize was as bad as it is. You know, and all the people who are claiming that the police officers are shooting the unarmed black people. I mean, it's just been a whole trend in the last year, and I was writing this even before it came out as much as it has, you know, in the last few months. So that, to me, I always wanted to believe that, you know, we were past that and kumbaya and, you know, we can all, because I don't have a problem with, you know, I'm not a racist, so I guess I didn't know it was there as much as it really was. So it was very alarming to me to see. But it's a history, you know, and it's a whole history thing with the Confederate flag and what it stands for and how people have such different perspectives on that in South Carolina. That was just fascinating to me because it's just so different from where I live here in California.
You also mentioned, and this is, I guess, this is the most one of the most interesting statistics that you cite, is that Pee Wee Gaskins, again, the killer of 14 and one while he was on death row, and this is one of the fascinating stories, is Pee Wee Gaskins Jr. But he is the first white man in the U.S. in 50 years executed for killing a black man, and 111 years in South Carolina. And you say 0.2% of all executions nationally are for whites killing blacks.
Right, got that right out of the New York Times. So it was, crazy. Just crazy stuff.
I never
knew that about South Carolina.
Yeah. We mentioned in the opening about a fascinating story about, unbelievably, Soldier of Fortune magazine, for people that don't know what that is. But Soldier of Fortune magazine and the case of, we're talking about Richard Braun, Hitmen for Hire. This one is somewhat comedic, if it weren't so tragic and fatal.
Yes. Keystone Cops.
But it is a real comedy of errors going on here, unorganized crime at its height. But this is in 1985, June. Richard Braun, he has a girlfriend named Marion, and he works at a company called Reliance in Atlanta. And there is someone, when he has these explosions in his vehicle, and the police ask, geez, do you got somebody that might be pissed at you? And they say, well, come to think of it. And he mentions somebody named Mark Braun and Mike Kaplan. So tell us about Richard Braun and this, where he's at, Cocaine Anonymous at this time, and a person named Michael Jackson and grenades and this comedy of errors and unorganized crime. Tell us a little bit about Hitmen for Hire.
Okay, so one thing I just want to say off the top is I was actually thinking of doing a longer separate version of this because it was the most comp story to try to research and to try to tell because it's a national story, and I was trying to make it about Georgia. So I just picked one of the murders to really go into, and that was Richard Braun. But there was this whole, I don't really want to call it organized crime because it wasn't very organized, but
yeah.
There were just these really seedy guys, you know, one in particular, and he just got this idea. He's, you know, been in the military briefly, had been a prison guard, and just had this idea. You know, he goes and he gets this strip club, and he reads this Soldier of Fortune magazine and sees that people are advertising in the back, I mean, pretty blatantly advertising their services, basically, you know, as people can go kill someone for you. And he realized that, you know, he'd get these calls at the payphone at the bar, and these people, mostly men, wanted someone to go kill their wives so they didn't have to pay, you know, divorce and alimony and stuff. And it was pretty bizarre. These guys that he used were young. They had this idea that they thought it would be cool, you know, to be hitman. And it was just absurd because they were constantly trying to set bombs that didn't go off properly. And they were, you know, just total lowlifes. But they did end up killing two people. And Richard Braun was only one of them. And it was sad because, you know, he was he was a drug addict, and he had been doing some stuff with this guy in this business, and he knew it wasn't really ethical and wasn't really right, so he was trying to get out. He was trying to get straight. He was trying to get off drugs, met this woman in AA or NA, it wasn't really clear. And next thing you know, he gets, you know, there's a bomb in his car, and he managed to not be killed at the first attempt, but they eventually come back and shoot him. And this one of these lowlifes shows up with the, you know, ski mask on and camouflage and this and that. And it's just like there were so many different moving parts to this story because it was all over the country and there were episodes of it. And so it turns out that alcohol, ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is the one that ended up coordinating this case because it had to do with explosives and guns being sent across straight lines. And this guy was operating out of one place, and, you know, they were traveling and killing people in different states. And because it was all in the back of the Soldier of Fortune, which is a national magazine. And to me, I just could not believe that it was so easy to hire a hitman just right out of a magazine.
Yeah.
And there was another case, which I didn't go into very much. I just mentioned it in there, which took place in Florida. So about a woman who was, and these were innocent people. These people had done nothing wrong. They just had, you know, scummy husbands or boyfriends or whatever, you know, or somebody who wanted their money. And it was all about greed mostly. That's what was so sad about it, is these innocent people were getting killed. The woman in Florida was perfectly nice, you know, government worker, you know, well-liked and everything. And her husband hired this hitman and killed her in bed. And he's the same guy who killed Richard Braun in Georgia. So they got tried in a whole bunch of different states, and I was reading all these different news articles trying to piece it together because nobody, it seems like no single reporter was able to pull it all together. So that's something I was trying to do on my own all these years later. It was pretty fascinating but pretty difficult, and it was one thing that was really interesting. You know the author Michael Connelly?
Right.
He writes crime fiction. He was one of the reporters who actually wrote some of these stories when he was still a reporter down in Florida.
Oh.
And so he wrote a piece of, a couple pieces on this and kind of hinted at the, you know, the national angle of it all. But I was like, hey, wait, there's Michael Connelly. He even got in on this. So that shows you how long ago this was before he was an author. Before he even went to the LA Times, he was a reporter in Florida.
A profound part of your book is you have the scene where the assailant is dressed in a camouflage jacket and jeans and tennis shoes, and he has this Mac 11 machine pistol, and he's aiming at this Mercedes, and Richard Braun's son, Michael, is
mm-hmm.
with him, and he sees that it has some kind of seems like a homemade aluminum foil silencer with a Coke bottle. So
right.
Tell us about this little scene that you describe that, again, you say the innocent people that are involved. Well, this is his son witnessing this hitman coming for his father.
Basically, you just captured what's here. Richard and his son are driving out the driveway of the house, and this guy comes out of the bushes, essentially, wearing this outfit, carrying this thing, and Richard slams on the brakes, and they both duck. Richard opens his door and rolls out onto the ground with the car still running, and his son Michael did the same thing, but Michael was on the other side of the car, and so he didn't really get shot, but the guy with the gun basically, you know, they're meeting eye to eye, and Michael, the son, goes, please don't shoot me. And so the guy lowered the gun, put his finger to his lips, and goes, shh, quiet. You know, so he didn't kill the kid, you know.
Right.
So this guy, apparently, all these years later, the guy with the gun has apparently found religion and, turned over a whole new leaf in prison, supposedly, and, you know, feels bad about what he did. But he did kill two people, so...
Does he again, what happens afterwards in terms of this hitman? How do police finally crack this? How do they get to the source of
it's really complicated.
Soldier of Fortune magazine?
It's so complicated because there's all these different cases happening in all these different states, and little by little, this ATF guy is coordinating it, and they don't know that these cases are all related, you know, so it takes a long time for law enforcement, especially in different states. You know, it's hard enough when you're in the same state and you have stuff going on in different counties that law enforcement doesn't even know what's going on, but this is even more difficult to solve. But basically, you know, they started putting it together. It was really difficult to actually piece that together and make sure that it was right, but you know, all over the country, there were these series of incidents, and then these ATF people started meeting and talking to each other and comparing notes about the bombs, and they started tracing where the bombs went, and it traced back to the guy who was hiring everybody, the guy who was placing the ad in Soldier of Fortune. And it was really ridiculous, too, because the guy who ended up killing those two people, he got caught, they took his gun, but they didn't realize that the gun was linked to the murder that had just happened, even though, you know, they had it in their evidence locker. The information hadn't been entered into the computer yet. You know, the thing with Dylan Roof where he bought a gun and he shot all these people and he should never have been able to do that, but the FBI screwed up and didn't enter, some clerk didn't enter the right information or whatever. Same kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
This stuff happens, and even when we have, you know, the laws in place, and even though we have these checks and balances, these guys can just, you know, kill somebody, get caught for something else, be held at a police station, and because the information's not in the computer, they can walk free and go kill somebody else. And that's pretty much what happened here. So, but eventually they caught up to him, and they traced back the guns, they linked the ballistics, and ended up having trials in all these different states. These guys had to be tried over and over again, and there was another guy who was killed. Anyway, so it was like this whole ring of people, and because they were so bad at it, you know, the police were able to solve it because they kept screwing up.
Well, one good thing, Soldier of Fortune magazine declined to or discontinued
doing
their classified ads.
No, they kind of were forced in and pulling those ads, and, you know, not running those ads anymore, but the guy who runs that magazine sounds like quite a character, you know. Sounds like a Larry Flint, except in guns, you know.
Yeah. You talk, we won't get into, again, we don't have time to get into too many of the specifics, and some of these stories are very, very complicated, but could we talk a little bit about Pee Wee Gaskins Jr., just a little bit, in terms of how he ends up killing somebody on death row?
Yeah, that was the best part of this story because, you know, the first part, it was pretty nasty, and he's killing everybody, and I was reading over the story today. There were so many names, all these people, and how they were all related to each other wasn't even that clear. But he's in prison, and he basically confesses to, you know, where all these bodies are buried, and, you know, and he says there are all these other bodies, and, of course, no one can find them, so we don't even know. But he's one of these people who... he's really short. He was sent to reform school really young. He was a twisted kid. You know, he found erotic pleasure in, you know, pain and raping other people, and from a very early age. So the kid was twisted from the start.
Sure.
And so he kills these people. He kills, again, you know, doesn't like black people, doesn't think they should mix and mate. And therefore, one of the victims was a multi-race child, you know, and the mom, he killed them both, you know. And so the guy, he was just a bad seed across the board. But anyway, so he's in prison, and he's on death row. This was a little confusing. I think he was on death row, but then they... didn't execute anybody, sort of like we have in California where we have all these, you know, 800 people on death row and then nobody gets executed it's been 10 years since they've executed anybody and they're still sending people to death row. Well, that's kind of how it was in South Carolina. So he's on death row and there's a guy in the cell next to him who's in there for killing the parents of this guy who's on the outside, and they get the son of the victims is getting more and more frustrated because, you know, this murderer is not getting executed. So he's getting very frustrated. There's a number of trials too, retrials, and they keep reconvicting this guy, but still he's not getting executed. So this guy is so upset, he decides he wants to somehow get this guy killed in prison. So there's somebody on the outside who hooks him up with this guy, Pee-wee, who's got a reputation, and he's also been a hitman, you know, hired as a killer previously. So
right.
Basically what they decide to do is the guy on the outside, you know, start sending different kinds of poison through the, somebody's shoe and this and that. And so Pee-wee tries to feed this guy in the cell next to him. He's got people who work for him and deliver things, and they've got this whole system in prison where you have to do people favors or they, I don't know, beat you or rape you, I guess. I don't mean to laugh. It's just so bizarre to me. But he basically gets this guy working for him who delivers meals, and so he tries to poison the guy next to him, and the guy just gets sick, and he tries a couple different times, finally gives up and says, this isn't working. I need some kind of explosive. You know, you need to send me some explosive. So somehow they smuggle in, like a stick of dynamite and something else, and I don't know exactly how it worked, but he came up with this idea and this contraption. He and the guy next door used to talk to each other through the air vent, and it just wasn't, they couldn't hear each other that well. So he was like, I'm going to rig up this, you know, kind of phone system. That's what he told the guy. So what he did is he stuck the explosive somehow into the bottom of this cup, and, you know, there was a wire. So he, like, put that through the vent and said, here, connect this wire to the bottom of this cup, and we'll be able to hear each other. Like, let's play phone, right? So the minute the guy sticks the wire into the cup, it basically blows him up in the cell. So Pee-wee Gaskins gets away with killing somebody in prison next door with smuggled-in explosives. I thought that was pretty amazing at how completely ridiculous the prisons are being run in South Carolina. Of course, that was that, what, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? But still, I mean, you would think that they'd be able to stop stuff like that. I've never heard of anything like that happening in California. I don't know. But I thought that was
wild.
And
Gaskin still caught red-handed with all of this stuff in his cell, including soldering irons, still tries to put it on the go-between, and says, again, he's not innocent. He's, you know, framed. And it's amazing.
It was crazy. Just a crazy guy. And then he writes this autobiography with somebody else, and basically doesn't even apologize, has no remorse. You know, I had a reason for doing everything I ever done, and, you know, et cetera. It was just, I don't know where these people come from, but they were amazing to me that there are people out there like this.
Now,
I don't know about
another
you, but
case
I don't think about killing people. I don't know.
No, not that often. So. You have a strange, again, all of these cases are amazing, but again, one of the other cases I thought was particularly interesting was the Vicki Robinson and Valesa, her daughter.
Uh-huh.
In the dynamic between these two women, the mother and daughter, and what had happened. Why did you pick this story, and what was interesting about this story for you?
Well, okay, so I kind of have a little a rule that I go by. When I'm picking a story, when I'm picking a book about murder, I want to do something different each time. I don't want to write the same story twice. And, you know, there's all different kinds of murders. There's hitmen for hire, which I wanted to do, so I did that. Teens killing parents. I've never written about that. I wanted to do that. So I picked that one, and I also picked another one where there was a teenage girl who killed her father. And so we have a matricide and a patricide. I also picked those two together because they had such different outcomes. So Valesa Robinson ended up getting out of prison And the other girl ended up staying, you know, in prison for life. And so I thought that was interesting, too. And even from state to state, you know, when I put these together, there are women who kill boyfriends or, you know, kill someone, and they don't pull the trigger, and yet they get the death penalty when the guy who actually pulled the trigger ends up getting life and gets paroled. And in other
yeah.
cases, even in the same state, you know, it's just so completely disproportionate, and, you know, the laws are not applied equitably. Do you know what I mean? So that's kind of what goes into
sure.
my story choice, is I'm looking with these different cases. Remember, I mentioned that I paired the two teen killings, and then I paired the two, the one about Melissa that we talked about at the beginning, killing the guy
right.
she didn't know for very much, for very long. I paired that one with another case in Florida with a woman who had dated her boyfriend for 18 years. So, you know, here we have two knowing somebody for 3 weeks, getting life in prison, yet the woman who uses the hammer and the gun and the poison and all the other things, she ended up getting, I forget what the sentence was, but it definitely wasn't death and it wasn't life. She got a chance at parole, I think, after 25 years. So I just thought, you know, it's really interesting to me, even in the same state, that you get such disparate punishment, you know, and different sentences and different charges, and just depending on the, I don't know if it's depending on the prosecutor, depending on the county, depending on, I don't know whether it's sunny outside. It just, to me, was just very strange. So back to Valesa, I also thought, you know, she and of whom, you know, had a boyfriend who they got to kill their parent. They were just, I just don't understand. I don't understand that. It happens sometimes, but it just, what is going through a kid's head? Are they born like that? I mean, I know there's a lot of kids who don't get along with their parents, but I mean, honestly, to have them, you know, to have them down on the floor and to stick a syringe in their neck full of bleach, you know, with an air bubble in it, premeditated. And then that's not enough, so they need to stab her because she won't die. I just, it's unfathomable to me that you can do this to your own mother. Who, you know, as far as we know, never abused her, never did anything except try to discipline her, you know? So.
Well, I got to say, though, that it seems that there's a real disconnect between the parents and the kids. And there is a kid that wants to rebel, and the parents are naive, will say, but these parents were the other way in terms of they were going to put her in this Christian school, this, again, institution, basically. It wasn't like
right.
just a private school. So it was their plans for her were something that she would definitely rebel against. And she had this bad boy boyfriend, as you described, that had been in jail. Not that it was in between petty and serious, I guess. He was on his way to be a developing criminal. But, again, yes, injecting her with bleach, that was a horrific scene in this book. And then that's not working fast enough, or it didn't do what they wanted to do so they could stab her. Then they go on this
right.
three-day drug-fueled party. I think this is where the jury just hates these people, you know. And whether it's a young woman or not, they just hear about the 10-carat gold ring at Walmart
right.
and the 20 bags
right.
of concrete and the trash bags and the party.
Right, that was a whole scene to me. Like, here you're in, I think it was, what was it, Walmart or Target or something like that, and he buys her this gold ring so they could pretend to be married, you know? It was just, it was like out of a movie. It was out of one of those movies that I don't want to watch because it's so depressing. And so, this is real life. These are real people. They're like, you know, I just shake my head. I just shake my head. I think
well,
with the
right,
other woman... The other woman who was with the guy for 18 years and used the hammer
right.
and the gun and the, you know, I actually did quite a bit of research on that one, and he was from San Diego, you know, where I live, and he
right.
was the guy who owned the dealership where I bought my car, as it turns out, and
yeah.
so I thought, wow, that's pretty that's a coincidence, right? So I investigated his murder, and I understood her motivation more than I understood these kids, you know, even though she went so over the top, and that became the title for the singles about Florida. It was kill him some more. I mean, how many things do you need to kill somebody? A hammer and a gun and poison in the gin, and I forget what the last thing was, a knife. So I was just like, God, how many different ways do you need to try to kill somebody? They're probably already dead, and that's how angry, clearly, she was at him. But at least I understood that a little more, because 18 years, he's a rich guy, he wouldn't marry her, and, you know, according to her, he threatened to shoot her, and so while he was, you know, passed out, she killed him. And killed him some more. So that to me, you know, I wouldn't do it, but at least understand the motivation a little bit more. And she claimed that when he got drunk, he was very abusive, and this had been a long history of this. And so that to me at least made a little more sense. But these kids and killing their parents, they just were like taking the joyride and doing all this drugs and let's kill him, let's kill my mom. You know, I'm just like, wow, really? So.
What was the prosecution's case against the long-term relationship and her killing what she said was an abusive husband? How did they proceed in terms of prosecution and defense on that?
See, now you're asking me specific questions I don't remember. I think they basically just didn't believe her. She tried for the, you know, battered spouse, even though they weren't spouses. They were living together.
Right.
And they just didn't buy it. They just basically said, you know, you wanted his money. You were, you know, the gravy train was over. He wanted you to leave, and you were angry at him. So I think that's probably what if I remember correctly, that's what the prosecution argued.
And there was talk. He did say to her, listen, I'm going to be seeing other people. So
yeah,
there was,
I mean,
all of that. There was a long-term relationship,
yeah.
But there had been a few couple years where they weren't together, so it seemed like he had convinced her to come back, or they had convinced each other, and then there was this other, again, another breakup again.
Right. And because she was a young stewardess when they met, and by the time she's in her 50s, and she's not so cute anymore, and she's, you know, has to dye her hair, and she's older, and you know, she was angry because, you know, you hang in there long enough, you think you're supposed to get something out of it, and then they just drop you, and they have all the money and all the power, and you get thrown out. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I could understand that. And if he really was as abusive as she says he was, although I interviewed somebody who knew him some years earlier and said, you know, I saw him drink, but I never saw – he was like a really funny, really friendly, fun guy. Never saw him even remotely upset. But then again, his own lawyer told me that he saw him, you know, kind of some entitlement issues, you know, with having the money and not trusting people who are trying to supposedly get his money. And so it's all in the book.
Right, yeah.
Interesting, though, that he was owned the car dealership. The car that I have sitting in my driveway right now came from his dealership. I thought that was really interesting. Felt like I was supposed to write that one.
Now, we talk about in the last part of your book, you talk about a Kelly Renee Gissendaner. Maybe I mispronounced that. And
I think that's
again,
right.
a lot of these cases where these women are victims of abuse, which should and does factor into these cases and their fates.
Right.
Again, tell us a little bit about just the overview of this case with Kelly Renee Gissendaner and what you were. I guess, what the story itself demonstrates.
The reason I picked this case is because I felt like she was a really pretty horrible person. I thought, you know, what a horrible person. Why would she kill this perfectly nice guy who never abused her, never did anything to her? She just, again, though, came from a background of being molested and abused and raped and ended up with this guy, divorced him, they got back together, you know, she had kids with him, and I don't think, you know, there wasn't any abuse in this situation. There wasn't anything except she was greedy. She wasn't in love with him anymore, and she fell in love with this other guy, and she got the other guy, to kill her husband. And that to me, you know, and there was nothing in it except she thought there was life insurance money. Turned out there wasn't. She didn't want to keep getting back together with the guy. And so her lover, who she was in love with, didn't want her going back with her husband because she kept going back for some reason. I don't know why. And so that's supposedly why he agreed to kill the husband. And not in a pretty nasty way. He took him out to the forest and made him, you know, kneel down, hit him in the back of the head, all this. I mean, it was just mean. It was just a mean, rotten thing. But the reason I picked this case is I really feel like she changed in prison. I really feel like she did actually finally turn into a better person. And the interesting thing about her case was it got national attention. It got international attention. The Pope even got involved in trying to get her get the death penalty commuted because she found religion. And, you know, a lot of people do find religion in prison in order to try to get out, you know, and make it look like they have changed. But it seems like she really did. She was commended by other inmates for helping them, for talking them through difficult situations when they felt like killing themselves. And they formed groups and they wrote letters for her. There were all kinds of people, petitions and everything. And like I said, the Pope even got involved. Now, the Pope has an agenda in that, you know, they don't believe in the death penalty. And he came here in 2015 and even spoke about, you know, I really think you should not have the death penalty in this country. And so the U.S. ambassador for the Pope actually wrote a letter to, I don't know if it's the DA's office or the prison or whoever, but basically it tried to intervene in this case because she, you know, studied. She got this degree. She was writing letters with this theologian in, I don't remember what country, and he was impressed by her, came to visit her, and so she was helping people. She really did seem to be helping other people in prison. And you know, they often use that at trial, at sentencing. Oh, you know, you should spare this person's life because they're smart or they're this or they're that and they can help other inmates. And, you know, it's usually just something that they say and I don't believe it. This case, it was actually happening. So that's the reason I picked this case, because it seemed like she was such a crummy person to start with, and like it really did seem like she changed. So, and her husband was again another one of these innocent victims, hadn't done anything wrong at all to deserve that. So,
you do also cite the two family members of the victim didn't approve of the death sentence either, so they were fighting against it as well.
Right, there were three kids, and two of the three kids managed to stop being angry enough at her that they actually went on the very last day before she was supposed to be executed, and rather than visiting her one last time, they went and tried to plead to keep her from being executed. So, yeah, her two kids who loved their dad, you know, or stepdad, whatever, they wanted her to save her life too. So.
And you do cite, again, I don't know if I'll be able to get the stat that you cite, but it is extremely rare
that.
For extremely
oh, yeah.
rare.
Well, the other thing is, I was just reading this again today. I went through and read over all the different other cases. As I mentioned this earlier in our conversation today about the disproportionate application of the death penalty. Even
sure.
in Georgia, there were all these other cases I listed, some of the more serious ones, where they were the ones who did the killing. You know, she wasn't there. She didn't do it. She helped plan it. She helped mastermind it. But she wasn't the one who pulled the trigger, and she wasn't even there. So that's really unusual. And it's also really unusual just to have a woman on death row in Georgia. It's pretty unusual to have women on death row, period. That's part of the reason why I picked some of these. And she was only the second woman in Georgia's history to be executed, and there are none on death row. There is not a single other one, at least at the time that I wrote this, in Georgia on death row right now since she's been executed.
Yeah, that's another part of these amazing stories or these amazing stats that just are part of the story itself and just
right.
Fascinating. Now, with this Notorious USA series, there are plans for how many more states do you have? I mean, how many states have you done so far in the series?
Well, that's it. I did 3 states, and that's my part.
That's your contribution.
I moved on to other book projects. I worked on these for about 6 months to get these 3 states. So I worked really hard on it. I mean, I was not intending to spend that much time on it, but I can't do anything half-assed. So I ended up really going into the research, and even though they're each one of these is a magazine length story, generally, except for the very first one we talked about, which was really much longer because, like I said, it just the more I got into it, the more unfair it seemed. But they're a magazine length story, but I still had to do a lot of the research that I would do for a book. I just didn't write as much about it, you know. So I did those, and then I got back to writing book projects. And, you know, I'm also a writing coach and teacher. And so that's it for me, for at least for now. So I have an essay that I've been working on that I was going to publish in October for Domestic Violence Month about my marriage, my late husband, and my relationship. And it's taken me about 17 years to finish that essay, and I still couldn't quite get it published this month. But I'm going to – it's called Secrets, Lies, Smirnoff, and Shoelaces, which gives you an idea. But, yeah, so I'm back to book projects, and I'm working on something on Manson, which I'm not allowed to talk about, but I can at least say that. It's fascinating.
Well, that's good. Glad to be that squeaked out. Before we stop talking about Love Gone Wrong, what is it about the, again, I mean, it sounds like a dumb question, what wouldn't we want to know about the 9 African Americans were shot during this Bible study? But just give us a little glimpse of the story itself in, again, incredible when he sits around in a group, he's invited into this church, this odd man. Just give us a little bit of that story. Don't give us the whole thing,
and
but just give us a little bit of that theme.
Right?
Absolutely.
Then we're gonna, okay. Well, I think, you know, Dylann Roof, I had to write this one. It's the only one where he hadn't been tried yet, so I had to be careful because he is still accused, even though, you know, it's clear we have it on videotape, him walking into the church and all those people were dead, and he's pretty much already said that his lawyer said he would plead guilty if they took the death penalty off the table, so it's like he's already pretty much admitted it. But basically, you know, he walks into this church, which he purposely chose, according to his friends, that he purposely chose this because it was a historic African-American church. He had been reading up on all of this racist, you know, propaganda online, and basically decided that, you know, black on white crime was spiraling out of control and somebody needed to do something about it. And so he's one of these drifters, aimless, you know, has no life, has no real job, using drugs. His parents are, I couldn't really tell if they didn't care about him or if he was just a pain in the ass, but he, you know, he was like staying with some other group of friends who sat around and, you know, did drugs and played video games and drank, you know. It's like the young white man, uneducated, feeling disenfranchised, feeling disillusioned, feeling generally pissed off, goes and kills a bunch of people because, I don't know, he thinks it's going to, he wanted to start a race war. I mean, which actually supposedly was the motivation, at least cited in court in the Manson trial. You know,
right,
it's just like,
yeah.
I don't know if he did a lot of reading or something, but there's just the ideas. You know, he wrote some manifesto about, you know, no one else is doing it, I'm going to go do it, and I'm going to take care of this, you know. And it was like he already knows his life was going to be over the minute he did that, but he felt like it was important. So he goes into this church and shoots all these people who are, you know, in the middle of Bible study, and they welcome him in, and he obviously doesn't belong there. He's the only white person, and they welcomed him in, and then he ended up shooting them, 9 of them. So I thought that was pretty horrific. And again, you know, they were all completely innocent people. They had not done a thing to him. He didn't know any of them. You know, he's just one of these people who wants to be famous, I think, and had nothing else in his life that was going the way he wanted it, so this is how he decides to take matters into his own hands. And it's just, it's so abominable to me that people do this stuff, you know. And time and time again, you know, we see these young white guys, and I don't get the feeling he's mentally ill. I don't know. I don't think we know that yet. I don't know if they're still in jury selection or where they are with this case, but I'm waiting to hear, you know, what is it? What is there anything? Is there any mitigating circumstance at all that would cause this kid to do this? Because in some of these other cases where they go in and they shoot a bunch of people, oftentimes they're mentally ill. In this case, I don't know yet, but I didn't get that feeling.
Well, given the emotional response, that regardless, I don't think he's going to get in, and he's not going to be convicted as someone that was insane. I don't think insanity defense will work in this case. Far too emotional.
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I mean, and I don't think we know enough about what the defense is going to do, but he's got a really good lawyer. He's got a very the guy who is representing him, I think it just maybe just the federal case. I'm not sure if he has a different lawyer for the state case. I think he was trying to remember. I quoted him in the Pee Wee Gaskins story, I think, but I don't remember if he was his lawyer or just one of the people who was quoted. But he's an expert, you know, he's a death penalty expert in South Carolina, so
right.
He's got a great lawyer. So we'll see what his lawyer does for him. I'm just really curious to know, you know, is there anything that would, you know, explain a little bit more other than he just hated black people, you know? That's an overwhelming, that just makes no sense to me, but what can I tell you?
Well, I
none
think the
cases,
lawyer,
if
he's
none
really,
of these cases make sense to me. They're all just crazy people.
If he's an excellent lawyer, which he is, then he's going to plumb the depths of possibilities on the defense,
right?
Because he doesn't, number one, he and other people don't believe in the death penalty itself anyway. And
right.
This is part of it, and why, and that's part of taking the case as well.
Right.
Talk about another incredible case. Let's talk about the update, the new addition, and
yeah,
the new developments in the Dead Reckoning case, the Skylar DeLeon and murder of Tom and Jackie Hawks. Tell us a little bit about what is the new development and the reason for the new addition. Tell
okay.
us about that.
So I go way back with this case. This case, I spent 5 years working on the original edition of this book, which is, I think, probably more time that I've spent on any book so far. There were 3 trials. I had to drive, you know, 2 hours each way up in Orange County. I live in San Diego County. Skylar DeLeon, at the time of the trial, was living as a man, and he would come to court over time looking more and more effeminate. He came to court one time wearing a woman's jail jumpsuit. He started wearing mascara. He started, you know, looking more frail, putting some stuff in his hair. He just looked more and more feminine, you know. And the prosecution and the law enforcement basically just laughed and said, you know, he's just trying to get attention. He's just trying to act crazy to get sympathy. It put me in a kind of a weird situation, because as a reporter working for a newspaper for most of my career up until I became an author, you know, you have to be really sensitive to the LGBT community. You have to be sensitive to any kind of community that has its own people and its own issues. And when you get to covering a murderer who is an LGBT person, it puts me in a difficult situation, because I want to be respectful and sensitive to the people who are not killers, who are LGBT or transgender. And I feel like sometimes people just want to attack people who are killers regardless. And so this took me into a different kind of an area, and I've had to tread very carefully to not upset the victim's family members and not upset my sources who, you know, to this day still want to believe that, you know, people who are in prison don't have any rights. Well, the update is all about Skylar DeLeon transitioning, essentially, on death row into a woman, at least so far just with hormones. But California, in the federal court, there is a judge who granted two different inmates in two different lawsuits, granted gender reassignment surgery that the state was going to have to pay for. And so I'm trying to make this short, but basically because of these two decisions, and in the first case, the inmate, they was up for parole, and for the seventh time, they'd rejected a transgender born a man, transitioned to a woman in prison, just like Skylar. On the seventh try, after the judge had granted the surgery, the parole board said, oh, we're going to let you out. So that meant the state didn't have to do the surgery. No precedent was set. They released her. So she'd have to go pay for the surgery on her own. That's fine.
Right.
You know, that's how government works, I guess. And it was a tricky situation. Came up again. There was another lawsuit, and same thing. And a different prisoner, same judge, again, granted the surgery. Now, I always take this as a constitutional issue. It's not a personal thing. I am not sympathizing with killers. I just want to make that clear, because I've lost friends on Facebook over this, where people feel like I'm, you know, pushing for Skylar to get this surgery. I'm not. I'm just stating what the law says, what the courts have ruled, and that is we have a constitution. We have a constitution that demands that we treat prisoners they still do have certain rights, even though people who are victims and their victims' families feel like they shouldn't have any rights, they do still have rights. Under the Eighth Amendment, they have a right to adequate, quote-unquote, adequate medical care. So basically, the Department of Justice has actually weighed in on this and said that transgender medical care really does need to be applied fairly to inmates, just the same as it is in the community. So that's why this judge did this. These people are trying to cut off their genitals. They're trying to commit suicide in prison. They're getting raped, et cetera, et cetera. And under, you know, there's another amendment to the Constitution about, you know, cruel and unusual punishment. You're not allowed to. That's why we have reporters witnessing executions, you know, to make sure that they are treated humanely when the state executes them. So in this case, even though Skylar's on death row, Skylar killed in order to get money to pay for this surgery. So that's the part about this case that makes people even more angry, is that there is now a policy in California prisons, because of this judge making these rulings, the state prison system decided, you know, we don't want this decided in the courts over and over again. We're going to create a policy whereby these inmates can apply to have this surgery. And if they meet the criteria, they can get the surgery, but we're not going to grant it to everyone, and there's going to be criteria. And in those criteria, and this may be, you know, the reason I did the update was because I did a magazine story, and I went and visited Skylar up at San Quentin and talked with her for 2.5 hours. I was not allowed to use anything from the interview because her lawyer immediately sent me a letter and said, she's not competent to grant an interview. She's not mentally competent. I'm like, okay, seemed competent to me. But anyway, I wasn't allowed to use that, so I was allowed to observe. I could see she had cut her arms repeatedly. There were these big, giant purple welts that I could see where she'd cut herself, tried to kill herself with various objects. So I saw the scars. I saw that she seemed happier and more at peace, and she's more, you know, she's medicated, and, you know, so here she is on death row, living as a woman. And so that's what the update's about. It's basically what's going on with her, what's going on with the policy, and that the fact is now she wants to take advantage of this policy. But the crux of it is, okay, if she is mentally incompetent, she may not be able to get the surgery because,
right,
you have to be able to be competent in order to say, I want to have life-changing surgery. So that's one reason why she might not get it. And another reason is, under the criteria, they look at the circumstances of the crime vis-a-vis the surgery. And in this case, since he killed the Hawks in order to get money to pay for surgery that Skyler had already scheduled, that may be another disqualifying factor. And so those are the constitutional issues, and those are the criteria, and those are the reasons why Skyler might not qualify. So I'm just trying to be as objective as possible, still trying to be sensitive to other transgender people who might want to get this surgery who are not in prison. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
It's fascinating stuff, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The other thing is that what do you think, just as a journalist, the likelihood of Skyler ever meeting that criteria, given the attitude about the state paying for this and the idea that just a general hate on for Skyler De Leon, period?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, this was a really heinous murder, you know, and so what the victims are saying, the victims' families are saying, you know, this is heinous, and, you know, it's not that they don't feel like other transgender people should be able to get this surgery, but Skyler killed to get this surgery already, so why should Skyler be able to get what she wants in prison? That's especially when she's supposed to be on death row and is supposed to be executed, but because California hasn't executed anyone in 10 years, they just feel like it's like adding, you know, insult to injury, even beyond the point of, you know, of comprehension, and it just doesn't seem fair. And, you know, nobody I talked to, except for one person who was going to visit Skyler, nobody dollars should be used to pay for this kind of thing. But this is not, you don't get a choice on how your taxes are spent. You know, there are courts and there are judges and policies, and I was, you know, I was asked, well, is there someone I can write a letter to and object? And, you know, I basically quoted the monitor who's in charge of, you know, California's mental health system and medical systems were really screwed up. They had a lawsuit some years ago that I covered when I was still a reporter, but they have to have a federal agency come in and oversee some of this stuff. And I can't remember if it's mental health only or medical only, but they just said, you know, this is a policy, and, you know, even though we sympathize with the victims' families, you know, not everybody's going to get granted this surgery, but, you know, we have to go by these criteria, which are applied in the general community just as they are here, because that's the law. So.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. I want to thank you very much, Caitlin, for coming on and talking about your Notorious USA series, Love Gone Wrong, and thank you very much for the update on Dead Reckoning and Skyler De Leon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this interview. Yeah, I appreciate getting a chance to talk about all this stuff. So.
Well, it's always fascinating to have you come on and talk about these amazing stories, and so congratulations on another great series, Love Gone Wrong. And thank you for coming on, and hope to talk to you again real soon now that you've let the cat out of the bag about Mr. Madison.
Okay. Great. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Good night. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.